Hi everybody, JP here. Today we're proud to introduce a series of episodes sponsored by our new friends at Elekta, of course the makers of Gamma Knife, the technology pioneered by Lars Lexell, which has become such an integral part of neurosurgery, both in our history and in contemporary practice. Elekta has partnered with us to produce a series exploring Gamma Knife's applications to treat a variety of neurosurgical pathologies. And because we really haven't had much sponsorship on the show before, I just wanted to stress to all of you listening that while Elekta was good enough to sponsor the episodes and helped connect us with a really impressive set of international authorities in this domain, there was absolutely zero influence on the actual content of the discussions. What you're going to hear are, as always, genuine conversations with leaders in neurosurgery. With that said, we are very excited to bring these episodes to you, especially given how many prominent neurosurgeons from outside the United States we were able to speak to for this series. So look out for these episodes on the first Sunday of the month for the next few months, with regular episodes on the weeks in between. A great big thank you to our friends at Elekta for making this happen, and of course to all of you, our listeners.
This is the Neurosurgery Podcast.
Welcome to the Neurosurgery Podcast. Today, we are just very excited to have with us Dr. Bodo Lipitz. Dr. Lipitz is a neurosurgeon in Europe, and this is one of many episodes we're going to have coming out about stereotactic neurosurgery and specifically radiosurgery. Dr. Lipitz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, JP. Hello, Michael. I'm really glad to be here and to join you in this show, and I think it's quite unusual to have foreign or German participants here, so I'm deeply honored to be able to join you here.
Yes, and you know, I wanted to point that out. We do have some listenership in Europe, some listenership around the world, though obviously most of our audience is here in the States, and I know you split your time in a few sites across Europe, but I wanted to give you a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners in America who may be less familiar with your work, and just say hello, let them know where you're from, where you work, that sort of thing.
All right. Yes, I'm a neurosurgeon, trained neurosurgeon, started to work in neurosurgery in 1981, and started with stereotactic neurosurgery, and then did a lot of spine surgery, as is quite common in Europe and Germany in particular. But I was really fascinated about the concept of making tiny holes in miniature targets and changing considerably the life of people who need that. And then that was this kind of targeting really, really moved me in the beginning, and more than many other things. So, but after having trained that quite intensively, I considered that not to be enough for a neurosurgery. I did the proper neurosurgical training, and we did a lot of tumor surgery at that time. I learned a lot of what can be done and or shouldn't, maybe. That was the time when the skull base, rather aggressive skull-based surgery of the 90s were very popular. And then in the early 90s, I heard of the concept of gamma knife radiosurgery, and that really filled the gap because it allowed me to do stereotactic work, but for the first time with a really broad therapeutic background. And in order to learn that, at this time there was no gamma knife in Germany, and so I decided to go to Sweden, where the technique had been developed by a neurosurgeon, by Lars Lexell. And I joined the staff at the Karolinska Hospital and became a consultant at the Karolinska Hospital in neurosurgery. And was for a while responsible then for the gamma knife at the Karolinska, where the technique had been developed. Went to, after was it, 13 years, I had an offer to join the team in London, and at the Cromwell Hospital in London. And I did that in addition to Stockholm. So I commuted between Stockholm and London for a while. But my for private reason, my wife wanted to end up our expat life in Sweden and asked me to see if I can get a proper job in Germany. I met a couple of people who asked me to take over a Gamma Knife site in Germany here in Hamburg, which I did in 2014. And since then, I've been working here. I was the chairman of the European Gamma Knife Society for a couple of years. And between 2015 and 2021, I was the chairman of the radius surgery section of the European Association of Neurosurgery Societies, EANS. That's basically where I come from to where I'm at the moment.
Dr. Lipitz, first of all, you must have just been at the EANS meeting in Spain, right? That was just last week, right?
I was not because I had promised my wife to take this vacation that I was just in Italy at the same time, so I couldn't go. I couldn't come. I deeply deeply regret it, but not on behalf of our private life. I must say it was a wonderful vacation.
Excellent. Well, it's interesting. It strikes me that you're in Hamburg, correct?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah, and so you're actually right on the edge of Scandinavia, right? You're very close to Denmark, and maybe for our listeners, you could go in a little bit of depth because I suspect a lot of listeners are not aware that the birthplace of radiosurgery lies within neurosurgery, and it is a very storied history. I was just operating this morning and commenting on the Lexell Rongeur and how monumentally important Lars Lexell. Was in our history. He basically invented an entire new field, and how the Gamma Knife was the birthplace, and how it began as a treatment for pain, and then people only think of it for tumors now. But can you go in a little bit of the history for our younger listeners?
Yes, actually, the Rongeur, he was really proud of because of its beauty and functionality. This, and so he in his autobiography. I think he wrote as much about the Rongeur as he wrote about the Gamma Knife. Yeah, but you're right. The tradition is relatively old. Lars Lexell started in the 40s, in the early 50s, after Spiegel and Weiss had developed their first frame, and he made a frame for his own use here in Sweden. And at that time, in 1951, he actually had the idea to replace the steel of the tool, the surgical tool, by the beam, invisible beam, to achieve a similar effect. And as early as in 1951, he treated a patient with a trigeminal neuralgia with an apparatus, a movable X-ray tube, mounted on a stereotactic frame with a fixed focus setup. And obviously that was quite successful. So he continued with this radiation work. And to tell you the truth, one of the reasons was that he was appalled by the success rate or the lack of success rate of neurosurgery in the early 50s. Olive Kroner, who is very famous and one of the pioneers, of neurosurgery, but he had an outcome that was, of course, for us beyond comprehension with a very high rate of morbidity and mortality. And Lars Lexell, who was working with him, with Olive Kroner, thought that was unacceptable and something should have been done against that. And so he developed this tool, but initially he wanted to use it entirely for functional stereotactic neurosurgery. So he wanted to treat pain, he wanted to treat cancer pain, I believe one of the reasons was a private one because his wife was sick, but that's another story. But it was initially used to treat to treat cancer pain, and that worked, obviously. So he came up with the idea after having worked with Proton in the 50s. He had some animal experiments at the University of Uppsala in the 50s with proton beam radio surgery, which he found unpractical for a number of reasons. So he came up together with his physicist, Börje Larsson. He came up with this concept of converging beams, which were entirely mechanically focused by a tungsten helmet with the precision burr holes. And these precision burr holes were made by a company that was quite famous in Sweden because they had made propellers for submarines, and they have to be drilled extremely accurately in order to avoid unnecessary noise. And this company was prepared on to do this precision drilling, and they could provide the necessary helmet, but with the necessary precision. And it ended up with a precision drilling focusing 190 beams to an accuracy of 0.1 millimeter. So, and that was actually usable then. And in the first, in 1968, the first gamma knife was then built. And Lexell had the idea that the gamma knife has a tiny range of indication, and that would probably be enough to have maybe four or five worldwide, because he was more or less thinking of the radiosurgical tools being used in stereotactic radiosurgery entirely. And but in the early 70s, he gave each of the subspecialties the option to try what radiosurgery could do for them. So Steiner at that time used it for the treatment of arteriovenous malformations, and he obviously was extremely lucky. I cannot imagine it otherwise. But the first three patients he treated, he actually achieved an obliteration of an AVM without knowing anything. Nobody knows how he did this, but it worked. Jörn Norén and Steiner later went to Virginia, and Jörn Norén used it for the treatment of acoustic neuroma, also very successfully. And he later went to Brown University in the States. And Christer Lindquist used it in the late 80s and 89, the first time in the treatment of brain metastasis. So it was tried by several people in this department, and but of course, the spread was rather limited. And first, when foreign centers were interested, particularly Sheffield in the UK and at that time Argentina, and very, very early on Pittsburgh in the States with Doug Koncielka. So first then, radiosurgery really took off. And I would say, without Dade Lunsford and Doug Koncielka, radiosurgery would definitely not be what it is nowadays. They have really carried a heavy load in doing research and proving the pros and cons, and they are more than the second fathers of radiosurgery after Lars Lexell. I think he did not really grasp the importance and the tsunami in that he caused with his technique and invention, which
Dr. Lipitz, that's a fascinating history, especially for someone in training like myself. The idea of burr holes and mechanically focusing these beams is a far cry from where the technology has come today and the way we treat patients today with radiosurgery. So I wonder if, by way of contrast to those early roots that you describe and the early manifestations of this technology, because I know where we want to wind up with this conversation is some of your fascinating work in repeat treatments and the effects and the spread, as you say, of the beams in these patients. So to set the stage for outlining the innovative techniques you're using for more longitudinal care of patients by radiosurgery, perhaps you can describe where the technology has come today and how the beams have advanced, the ability to focus the beams have advanced, and how the invasiveness of the technique to deliver the treating radiation to the patients has been refined.
Yes, the what definitely has changed is the targeting. Not that much the precision of the beams. They have always been extremely high, but the targeting, of course, has improved massively. So we can use any targeting method today. We can use MRI and CT scan, obviously, and angiography, and we PET scans. We can use anything to target our focus in the brain, which is extremely important. And of course, since the initial first steps of radiosurgery, there has been a massive workload on publications. But what is interesting among these multiple studies that have been published, to see the trend, what is also changing the world around us rather than radiosurgery alone. And I would say if we now stay with brain metastases, I mean, we can go into benign tumors as well, but that's not the focus today. But if we stay with brain metastases, first of all, we have learned that it works, and which is, interestingly enough, against all radiobiological concepts that radiation oncologists had developed until the early 2000s. So we had to work in the early days in the 90s against many people who told us what you do is impossible to achieve because it does not correspond to the concept we have, theoretical concept we have. So the idea was not really initially to change the concept. That obviously was not quite correct. The idea was to say that this is not a realistic result that is seen. And now this is very slowly changing. And what's really exciting is that, first of all, this focusing radiation now swipes over to radiation oncology and is affecting lots of systemic treatments, which is an important move outside our field of brain radiosurgery. But also we are learning how this can be looked at in a changing scenery of now immunotherapy. What does radiation do with regard to immunotherapy, which is absolutely fascinating because this is something that we are just learning and while we speak, basically. It's very new. And we also see that some of those paradigms are just not correct and they don't really serve us very much. One very simple thing is when we deal with patients with brain metastases, in the majority of studies, new brain metastases are called remote failures, for example, or they are considered a failure of a treatment. But of course, that is coming from a time when whole brain radiotherapy was used, and the idea was spread also among patients that whole brain radiotherapy prevents new metastases from coming. Now we know that this is not the case. It only works in a very limited time span. But now we do see that patients develop brain metastases not only once, but with a stochastic likelihood in relation to the time of observance. And that's a very interesting thing. So it's not only a once-in-a-lifetime thing to develop a metastasis or a second metastasis. It's something that happens again and again with a stochastic likelihood. And that is something that was problematic for early radiation oncology because whole brain radiotherapy could not be repeated. So, of course, then a new metastasis was a failure. And the concept of this being a rather natural thing occurring from time to time was rather remote. We learn that this is more likely to be the concept, that with increasing lifespan of patients with brain metastasis, we see more and more brain metastasis coming. But that again changes our whole concept, because we can not only look at a patient with mets from today, we need to offer a concept that is valid even in 6 months or for the next metastasis in 9 months. And that's very important, because it introduces a long-term perspective into the management of patients with brain mets. And Masaki Yamamoto published with his Japanese group roughly 10 years ago, absolutely massively important study that showed that the prognosis of patients with brain metastasis does not depend on the number of brain metastasis. Of course, that is would have been extremely simplistic, but people still think that patients with three have a shorter survival than patients with two, or seven shorter survival than six, and so on and so on. That may be true in some aspects, but it's definitely not true in a simplistic way. And that may, of course, combined with the long-term approach, means that you need a treatment that you can provide, which is relatively simple, and non-invasive. You need something that the patient come to and be treated and maybe work the next day, or at least if it doesn't work, be at home unharmed. And that we are not really prepared to that, not with surgery, not with fractionated radiotherapy, definitely not with whole brain radiotherapy. So this, again, changes our concept, how to deal with these patients who suddenly become long-term patients. And that, I think, is very exciting, because radiosurgery allows us to do that, to deal with this on a long-term perspective. And then, with Masaki Yamamoto, we learned that we can treat patients with multiple mets without harming them. I mean, we can treat with today, it's absolutely routine to treat patients with 10 smaller brain metastases in one session. And it has never been published any paper that relates any side effect to the sheer number of metastases. It's always related to the volume of the metastases, but not to the number. And that's an important finding. So if you put all this together, we can treat many metastases. We can do this in a non-invasive way. We can send the patient home the same day and the patient is unharmed the next. And we can treat the patient over many years. And that changes how we see brain metastasis, and definitely changes the management of these patients. A patient has treated 10 times, and he's, for example, one of those is still working as a mathematics teacher, has had 60 metastases, small ones, but still, over a period of 5 years, and entirely unharmed, just as an example. Of course, there are studies also that prove the mental state that is unchanged by the number.
So, Professor Lipitz, this is really fascinating information, and it's always been controversial, right? And I think that you brought forth this new data that is the collective work of so many radio surgeons like yourself. And it, you know, really, it is the first and the most ultimate minimally invasive surgery. I mean, if you think about it, just as you've described, that you can extend life, that you can be so laser focused and not affect surrounding tissue in an adverse way, like with, say, whole brain radiation. So I think it's fascinating. And I'm reminded as to when I was a fifth year resident at USC, we had a 6 month gamma knife rotation.
Yeah.
Under, I'm sure you're familiar with Mike Capuzzo.
Yes.
And we spent a full 6 months working in the gamma knife, and it was beautiful to see the cobalt 60 and the different helmets that you put the patient into, and the helmets really are not attached to the patient. If you've ever seen it, it's beautiful. These highly geometric, well-engineered devices for targeting inside the brain. And I'm thinking about, wow, this is one of the only technologies that's with high-level technology that's withstood the test of so many decades and still relevant and transcends. And you're talking about neuro-oncology, but I know you use device for a treatment of vascular lesions, for treatment of pain, functional, yes, and skull base, right?
Absolutely.
You do all these things.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the massive advantage, also as you were saying, in skull-based radiosurgery, this is a sort of a conflict between classical neurosurgery and radiosurgery, or at least has been until quite a while. But now I think we worked out a way of completing each other. So it works wonderfully nowadays when we don't have to radically excise skull-based meningiomas, but we can really do this with the patient's functionality untouched, and the remnants can be treated with radiosurgery, and this has changed the need for aggressiveness and surgical aggressiveness in skull-based surgery, but it has also turned out to be extremely beneficial for the patient. I mean, as I said, in the 90s, I remember a period also at the Karolinska Hospital where maybe shouldn't say that, but many patients came with after skull-based surgery and oculomotor paresis. And that is not absolutely necessary anymore. And we can combine, even with acoustic neuroma, we combine it nowadays with larger tumors, leaving the parts untouched, they're closer to the facial nerve, and even with larger tumors, with preserved, where we can provide preserved hearing through the lack of surgical aggressive. So I think this is something in skull-based surgery, the neurosurgery and radiosurgery have now adjusted to each other, and it works beautifully as a win-win-win situation where the patient is benefiting tremendously in comparison to earlier years. And in neuro-oncology, I think we are changing concepts more. We are treating patients more holistically, and that I think is interesting, and also that our approach now in the light of new immunological knowledge that we have from cancer, radiosurgery also comes into a new perspective, which is absolutely fascinating if we, for example, see the development of the treatment of melanoma metastases. Because for many, many years, we always said we can control these tumors, but we don't affect the lifespan of patients. But if you see now how first the immunotherapy or BRAF inhibitors changed a little bit, and then the addition of radiosurgery changed again a little bit, and then now the combination and the timing of both treatments obviously has an effect, and that's entirely new. We had no idea about the necessity to time a chemotherapy or immunotherapy with the radiation therapy to create a significantly better effect before. That's entirely new fields that we are now entering into. And that's, I think, utterly fascinating. And we haven't had no idea.
Well, Professor Lipitz, this is exactly the question I wanted to close with. And I'm grateful to you that unconsciously you've led exactly to where I wanted to take this conversation. Because in addition to the new science that you described regarding the timing and combination of treatments, the other elephant in the room, the third arm of care for cancer patients, in addition to conventional surgery and radiosurgery, is of course chemotherapy, and now the new section of chemotherapy, which is immunotherapy. And so yes, in addition to learning new protocols for the combination and the timing of these treatments, as you describe, I think the other biggest impact immunotherapy has had is just increasing the lifespan of patients with these cancers. And so I wonder if you could talk a bit within radiosurgery about how the increased lifespan we're seeing in some of these patients affects your planning and long-term plans for potentially repeat treatments. For example, on the spine side of things, for a long time, we didn't have to worry as much about the stability of a spine after some resections the way we would in a deformity patient, for example, because the natural lifespan of that patient would preclude them from developing long-term progression of instability. And so we could do fixation, fuse someone short-term to keep them stabilized for their regrettably shortened lifespan. But now, as patients are living longer with some of these new immunotherapies, we have to think more carefully about the construct we make after resecting and destabilizing the spine for a tumor case. So I wonder if similarly with intracranial mets, you're seeing longer lifespan in some of these patients. And so you have to think more diligently about planning the radiosurgery and how safely you can do repeat treatments on these patients who are living longer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can agree totally. There are two areas actually on this. The one is the trivially area of meningioma, which when I started with neurosurgery, we were told when you take it out, it's gone and over. And in radiosurgery, we're always forced to control our patients. So we published a 10-year follow-up, and we're quite surprised how many of those patients developed remote meningiomas or new meningiomas. So rather bringing this into an area of a long-term condition that also has to be dealt with in a long-term way. So that brings you again a bit away from the necessity of heroic interventions, more to something that you have to discuss with the patient. If I do this today, will I be able to do that 6 months from now, or in meningioma 5 years from now? And this is something that is really close to my heart, that we should, as neurosurgeons, have this depth, this perspective in depth, in time, in the future, when we consider what we are doing today. And I have the impression that this is not always the case. And now with metastases, as I said, it's absolutely fascinating if you see the development of melanoma brain metastases, for example, in the last 10 years only, where the survival rate has increased significantly from around 7-8 months to 22 months in current treatments in median. Even if this is a limited median, this is massive in oncology, of course, and we need to take this into consideration. So, for example, the current guidelines that are still focused on the number of brain metastases do not reflect that, let's say, new reality, because the longer patients live, if you have it as a stochastic process, the more metastases they will develop, which of course is not a practical thing to draw a line. If you have a patient in front of you who had 3 metastases, you cannot tell, I won't treat you because you are developing the 4th or the 5th. This is absolutely ridiculous in a practically clinical way. And we have to take that into consideration also in our scientific concept and our guideline concept, that things are more evolving in long-term perspective. And again, when we deal with these patients and now know that the median lifespan is rather extended. And for our patients here with brain metastasis, we have looked at 400 patients in more detail, and the likelihood to survive more than 3 years after the first occurrence of brain metastasis was roughly 30%. And that, of course, leaves you with a considerable amount of patients who come back to you on a regular basis. Also, I have to admit also maybe more patients who see side effects, because we have a typical time frame to develop side effects, which is in the range of 8 to 9 months. If patients survive longer than 10, 15 years ago, we of course have to deal with more of these side effects that are a natural consequence. So from that, we have to be very cautious in not to be too heroic by treating, for example, larger lesions, which is not a way to deal with tumors radiosurgically. These should be definitely, and without any discussion, be left to open surgery. But we have to be able to, for example, if the patient, I remember very well when I was trained, we had patients with 5-6 brain metastases, one of them was larger. We would refuse open surgery because there were so many others. That today is absolutely obsolete, because you can now take the larger tumor out and we can very successfully deal with the smaller brain metastases. So what I would say is, if we can take the long-term perspective into consideration, be a more holistic approach, for example, having a view also on the immunotherapy and the concurrent systemic treatments. In a later view, we need to see how that affects the timing. We have now a glimpse on this, but we have no idea yet, but we have very, very small perspective. So these things, both more in depth and in width, so we need to be a bit more holistic and more three-dimensional in dealing with these patients. But then we can be a bit more aggressive when it comes to deal with the multiple metastases, because there we have virtually no limitation. When we have patients with large tumors and we see them for a long time, we have to be very careful with radiation. And then in these cases, open surgery is the far less invasive method. So I don't know if that answers your question and your spin. But I think
it does perfectly, Professor Lipitz. And in fact, I think that the summary statement you made at the end is not only an answer to my question, but a wonderful recommendation or guidelines for people entering the field now of in the care of neurosurgical patients with tumors who will be offering radiosurgery. It is really fascinating and a privilege to get to hear from someone who not only can lay out the history of this technology and mode of treatment, but also is still at the cutting edge of it and the roles you've had in the leadership. It's a real privilege to talk with you. Just, you know, you were kind enough to send a CV before this interview, and I would have loved to get into your time in the military as a physician, the time when you were here in the States working at Duke in North Carolina. And so I'm sure we'll talk again and try to dig a little bit more into your specific career path. But for now, we really appreciate you sharing your perspective on the modern applications of radiosurgery and Gamma Knife. So Professor Bodo Lipitz, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Many thanks. Many thanks. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Disclaimer time. The opinions and ideas expressed in this show are solely those of myself, Dr. Wang, and our guests. They do not represent the opinions of any professional institution or organization. This show is for entertainment purposes only and does not constitute the giving of medical or legal advice. Listening to or participating in this show does not constitute continuing medical education or any other professional certification. It's just a show, everybody.